This is the Troubles Podcast, a podcast which explores the violence and bloodshed that occurred in Northern Ireland, the Republic of Ireland, and Great Britain as two sides waged a bloody conflict over the status of Northern Ireland. It was 11 minutes past 8 on Thursday, the 21st of November, 1974, when an anonymous phone call was placed to the Birmingham Post newspaper, warning that two bombs had been planted in the city centre. This was at the peak of the Troubles, and these calls were common enough that they weren't always taken seriously. But this caller had an Irish accent and also used the recognised IRA code word, which was double X. This meant that it was a legitimate threat. The caller said that there was a bomb placed at the Rotunda building and another one in New Street at the tax office. They then hung up. It wasn't unusual for bombers to call in their bomb threats so that civilians could evacuate in time. The bombs were intended to cause terror and chaos, but not necessarily to kill as many people as possible. IRA protocol was quite strict at the time when it came to the bombing of non-military institutions. The protocol stated that a call must be placed 30 minutes before a bomb was due to go off so that civilians would have time to escape. The killing of innocent civilians would turn a lot of people against the cause of the IRA, so they usually tried to avoid this happening. In this case, it is believed that the bomber was meant to place the call from a pre-selected telephone box that was nearby one of the pubs. The phone box that was selected had been vandalised, which meant that the bomber had to find a different phone box, and this delayed the response time from the police. The individual also failed to mention that the bombs were planted in pubs, mentioning only the buildings instead. The Rotunda building is a 25-storey building in the heart of Birmingham. And the Mulberry Bush was a pub that stood at the very bottom of the building. It was a popular place for young couples and individuals working at the nearby train station to socialise in Birmingham. Within minutes of receiving the call, police had arrived on the scene and began to search the upper floors for the bomb. But they were too late. At 8:17, just 6 minutes after the warning call was placed, the first bomb went off. It had been concealed in a bag and placed near where people sit at the bar. The pub was blown to pieces in the blast. The roof caved in and a small crater had been blown into the floor. 8 people were killed instantly inside the pub, and 2 were also killed as they were passing by. A number of other people were also injured, and many lost limbs as a result of the bombing. Just around the corner was a bar called the Tavern in the Town. The patrons in this bar had heard the explosion around the corner, but didn't realise that it was a bomb going off. Police had just begun attempting to clear the bar when, at 8:29, just 17 minutes after the initial call was placed, the second bomb exploded and caused massive damage in the pub. 9 people were killed instantly, with an additional 2 more who passed away later in hospital. The force of the blast was so powerful that some individuals were blown through brick walls. Brian Yates, a police officer who arrived on the scene, said of the explosion, "The dead were stacked on top of one another. Survivors were straggling around in the rubble screaming, their clothes in rags." Rescue efforts were delayed because of the location of the pub. It was in the basement of the building, and the only entrance or exit was destroyed in the blast. A number of the bodies were also stuck between rubble and electric underground cables, and the electricity needed to be turned off before any recovery operation could be undertaken. In the immediate aftermath of the bombing, the entire city of Birmingham came to a standstill. Buses were stopped, pubs were evacuated, and taxis were used to take the injured to the hospital as there were not enough ambulances. Doors from the bathroom of the pub were also ripped off their hinges to use as makeshift stretchers. At 9:15, a third bomb was discovered less than 2 miles away from the other two. It was concealed in a plastic bag outside a Barclays bank. The detonator activated when a policeman poked the plastic bag with his baton, but luckily the bomb did not explode. It was later destroyed in a controlled explosion. In total, 21 people died as a result of the bombings, and 182 individuals were injured. In the ensuing days and weeks, there was also a massive wave of anti-Irish sentiment all around England, but especially in Birmingham, where 100,000 Irish people lived. Irish-owned businesses were attacked, and Irish people were assaulted and received death threats, and some of them also lost their jobs. The St. Patrick's Day Parade, which was one of the biggest outside of Ireland, was indefinitely cancelled. 2 days after the attack, the Provisional IRA released a statement denying any involvement in the bombing. They said that an attack like this was strictly against their code of conduct, which allows time for civilians to escape. They went on to say that they would be having an internal investigation into these attacks, and that the bombing was in no way sanctioned by the IRA leadership. The Council of the IRA also placed Birmingham on a strictly off-limits list to service units of the IRA, which meant that there could be no cells operating in Birmingham or any future attacks in the city. The bombing in Birmingham caused a number of revenge attacks by loyalist paramilitaries in Northern Ireland. Within 2 days of the attack, 5 Catholic civilians had been shot dead. Back in England, the British government was quick to act and enacted the Prevention of Terrorism Act 1974. This gave emergency powers to police forces where they suspected terrorism was occurring. There was also debate in the House of Commons to bring back the death penalty for those convicted of terrorist offences, which gathered some support before being quashed. Upon analysing the scene of the bombings, investigators found that the bombs were between 25 to 30 pounds in weight and contained pieces of metal so as to cause maximum damage when they exploded. The material used in the bombs was also only available in the Republic of Ireland. This information, along with the official IRA code word being used, led police to believe that whoever executed this bombing had some sort of affiliation with the IRA. The hunt was on to find the culprits. In November 1974, IRA member James McDade died while planting a bomb in Coventry, England. On the same night as the bombing in Birmingham, McDade's body was also due to be repatriated back to Belfast, where he would have an IRA funeral. That same night, 5 men were in the process of travelling back from Birmingham to Northern Ireland to attend James's funeral. They were Patrick Hill, Gerard Hunter, Richard McElkenny, William Power, and John Walker. The men were from Northern Ireland, but had been living in Birmingham for a number of years. They knew James McDade from when they were younger, back in Belfast, and some of them also saw him occasionally in Birmingham, where McDade also lived. They had no idea he was in the IRA until the night he died, and it was reported that he died while planting a bomb. At the station in Birmingham, the 5 men were joined by Hugh Callaghan, where they had a drink. The 5 men then boarded a train to Heysham, which is a port town, where they would get a ferry back to Northern Ireland. While they were on the train there, the bombings occurred. When they arrived at the port town of Heysham, police were checking everyone that was going to Belfast, as the alarm had been raised and they were on the lookout for any individuals who looked like they were fleeing the country. In the ITV documentary, The Birmingham Six, Billy Power explained what happened next. "We were asked to hang on for a minute, on the quayside. We were free to go if we wished. We could have walked up on the gangplank onto the boat. We hung about because he had asked." The men explained where they were going, but they didn't really want to tell the full truth. They told police that they were travelling home to see their families. They didn't want to say that they were going home to attend the funeral of a member of the IRA. It was then the men found out about the bombings. Police officers then asked the men if they would come down to the police station to help with their inquiries. The men thought that they were helping with the investigation at this stage. The men's names were taken and sent to the police in Birmingham, where police confirmed that the men had no IRA affiliations and were not suspects, and said that they could let them go. But before they left the station, the chief superintendent asked to do some chemical tests on their hands. Jerry said in the ITV interview, "We were only too willing to help. And that was it. That was the last we seen of freedom." The men's hands were tested for traces of explosives by means of a grease test. The result of this test would then become the catalyst for the ordeal that was to follow. The doctor who performed the tests believed to have found traces of explosives on 3 of the 5 men. Jerry remembers one of the officers saying to Paddy, "You bastard, you're covered in jelly." Jelly in this case refers to the Gelignite bombs that were used in the attacks. Police then found the mask cards for James McDade in their pockets, and they were convinced that they had found their bombers. Based on this evidence, the 5 men were now prime suspects in the attacks. They were interrogated, beaten, and subjected to a number of other violations. The men recall that the police were careful not to damage their faces, instead beating them under their clothes, where cameras wouldn't see it. Hugh Callahan was then picked up back in Birmingham, as he had met the 5 men for a drink on the night of the bombing, which was enough to have him tagged as an accomplice. One day after the bombing, William Power signed a false confession, saying he was one of the bombers. He only signed this confession after hours of physical and psychological abuse at the hands of the authorities. The following day, 3 of the other suspects signed false confessions after hours of prolonged abuse, which included mock executions, food and sleep deprivation, and burning cigarettes on their bodies. Paddy Hill said in an interview that police said to him, "We know you did not do the bombing. We don't give a fuck who done them. We have our orders, and our orders, here they are," and he showed me, "Read that, you little Irish bastard." The men were then transferred to Winson Green Prison, where they were subjected to more beatings, and in one instance, one man lost 4 of his teeth in an assault by the prison guards. In later months, 14 prison guards were charged with assault, but were found not guilty. 1 week after the bombing, the IRA issued another statement, saying, "If IRA members had carried out such attacks, they would be court-martialed and could face the death penalty. The IRA has clear guidelines for waging its war. Any attack on non-military installations must be preceded by a 30-minute warning so that no individual civilians are endangered." The 6 men went to trial, where they emphatically professed their innocence, and they explained to the judge that they had never been in the IRA, and they didn't know that McDade was until the day he died. The prosecution had 3 things against the men, which were the results of the test, which showed traces of explosives on their hands, their signed confessions, and also character witnesses, which showed potential sympathies to Irish republicanism. During the trial, the defence asked for the signed confessions to be disregarded, as they were obtained under duress. The judge refused this. Though the confessions were used as evidence in court, the jury was not allowed to read each confession, which would have painted a very, very different picture. The 4 confessions all contradict each other and have factually incorrect details about the locations of the bombs. The trial went on for 45 days, and on the 15th of August, 1975, the Birmingham Six were found guilty of 21 murder charges and given 21 life sentences. Judge Nigel Brown said during the sentencing, "You stand convicted of each of 21 counts on the clearest and most overwhelming evidence I have ever heard of the crime of murder. Each man received a life sentence for their role in the killings." And that would have been it. But over the years, the narrative began to change. And gradually, the voices of the Birmingham Six began to be heard. In 1982, the civil rights lawyer Gareth Pearce began working on behalf of Patrick Hill. Members of the media and politicians started to campaign on behalf of them. In 1985, 2 scientists then tested the validity of the grease test by testing it against everyday objects that the men may have come into contact with on the day. It was found that many everyday items, such as playing cards, could be confused with traces of explosives and give a false positive in these tests. Then, in 1987, an ex-police officer came forward and said that he had witnessed the beatings of the men in prison. The case was then referred to the Court of Appeal, and after a lengthy appeals process, the conviction was upheld, with the judge saying, "The longer this hearing has gone on, the more convinced this court has become that the verdict of the jury is correct. We have no doubt that these convictions are safe and satisfactory." By 1990, the Greece test had been completely discredited, and as well as that, some police notes about the bombings were found to be fabricated. By now, there was very little evidence that actually pinned the bombing on the Birmingham Six. So as a result of that, on the 14th of March 1991, after nearly 17 years behind bars, the Birmingham Six were free. For the most part, the families of the 21 people killed in the bombings accepted that the men had been wrongly convicted. Julie Hambleton, who lost her sister Maxine in the attacks, was asked if she accepted the overturning of their conviction and said, "Yes, at the time we didn't. But since my brother and I, Brian, met Paddy Hill, who was one of the men who became known as the Birmingham Six, we do believe this man served time for a crime he did not commit." Which makes this all the more sick, that it's allowed in a country that claims to have the birthright to democracy and rule of law. The families of the victims continued to demand that justice was done and that the real bomber was found. The IRA has never officially claimed responsibility for the attack, but in 2014, the former Provisional IRA intelligence officer, Kieran Conway, admitted that the attacks were carried out by the Provisional IRA. Then, in 2017, former IRA bomb maker Michael Christopher Hayes told the BBC News that he took collective responsibility for the attack. He refused to name anyone else involved in the bombing, but explained that he was horrified when he heard about how many civilians were injured. He also claimed to have defused the third bomb after the first two exploded. He said, "We were horrified when we heard, because it was not intended. I personally defused the third bomb. It was not the intention of the IRA to kill innocent people. It wouldn't have been done if that was the case." It is unclear what the future holds in the case of the Birmingham bombing. In 1994, a public interest immunity certificate was imposed on any documents relating to the pub bombings. This means that government documents related to the bombings will not be released to the public until 2069. Family members of the victims believe this has been put in place so that they will have all passed away and there will be no one to lobby the government for justice for their loved ones. In recent years, relatives of the deceased are still campaigning for justice for their loved ones, and in April 2019, an inquest into the 21 victims was reopened. The inquest raised many questions about the police's response on the night. Here are some of the revelations that have come forward. On this night, the majority of the Birmingham police force had been deployed to deal with the body of James McDade being repatriated. As a result of this, the entire city of Birmingham only had 15 police officers on duty on the night in question. Police training on how to deal with bombs was also minimal. Detective Constable John Plimmer had visited the tavern in the town less than an hour before the bomb exploded, but he was not interviewed by his own force until 2018, 44 years after the blast. As well as that, recordings of emergency calls made to the police control room were usually kept for 30 days, but in this case, all the 999 tapes from the night had been wiped. A semi-automatic handgun was found near one of the pubs that was bombed. An officer handed this gun to his superior, who then later claimed that the gun was never in his possession and it disappeared. This gun could have been very useful in finding out who the actual bombers were. The third bomb could have provided valuable forensic evidence that, with technological advances, could have given leads to investigators who were searching for the culprits decades later. But the remains of the bomb have also been lost. The inquest concluded that though there were a number of shortcomings in the police, it did not contribute to the loss of life on the night. In 2011, Brian and Julie Hambleton set up a group called Justice for the 21. They've campaigned for a reopening of the trial, or at very least for the bombers to be publicly named. Patrick Hill also publicly supported the efforts of Justice for the 21. Speaking about the bombing and the loss of her sister, Julie said, "When people murder somebody, they don't just murder that person. They completely murder a whole nucleus of a family and other families who are their friends, because it leaves its stain and its shadow and its taint on everybody that knew that one person." And as far as the Birmingham pub bombings of 1974 are concerned, it has left a stain and a shadow and a stench so strong. And that is also part of our campaign, is to remove that stain, remove that stench, once and for all.